stay in the 80s.
Yeah, well, you can. All right, guys, have a great weekend, and we will see you
on the dark side.
On the next.
As he likes to say.
Yeah.
Good evening. It's 5 p.m. on Thursday, March 26th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering a new era for a beloved local arts organization and updates directly from City Hall from Tuesday night's council meeting. Without further delay, let's dive in. A long-standing arts organization in Kingston is entering a new chapter. Formerly known as Modern Fuel Artist Run Center, the organization has announced a new name and brand identity as it approaches its 50th anniversary next year. The organization traces its roots back to 1977. When it was first incorporated as the Kingston Artists Association. It was later renamed Modern Fuel in 1995, becoming a staple of the city's contemporary art scene. The organization will now move forward as Cultivate Art Commons, a rebrand reflecting a renewed focus on community-engaged artistic practice in Kingston while continuing its long-standing mission of supporting contemporary artists. Executive Director Maddie Andrews sat down with CFRC to talk about the change and what it signals for the future.
Well, to start us off, I was wondering if you could give us the backstory. What kind of prompted this decision to rebrand and why was now the right moment?
Absolutely. So this transformation has been years in the making. And it truly began to take shape during the development of our strategic plan in 2024. And so the strategic plan is set from 2025 through 2028. So this next chapter that we're in. And we developed it in collaboration with consultant Pavna Varma. And from the outset, we prioritized meaningful engagement. So connecting with our members through surveys and focus groups and consulting with community partners and key voices across the sector. And one theme emerged throughout our strategic planning process, an opportunity to strengthen our visibility and more fully express who we are. Community members encouraged us to deepen and develop our identity as a vibrant, inclusive art space here and expand our digital presence and better communicate the energy and purpose behind our work. So that was kind of phase one. And then with support from the Community Foundation for Kingston and area, we were able to move this forward in a meaningful way. So we received funding in the spring of 2025, and the board engaged BM Dodo Strategic Design as the consultant team we worked with on this project. And we selected them for their deep local knowledge and over 20 years of experience supporting organizations specifically in Kingston to guide this comprehensive exploration of our identity. And so throughout this process, research and community input remained really central. We shared a survey with our members and our key collaborators, inviting feedback on how our name and visual identity could better reflect our work, especially in today's more environmentally conscious context. So that's kind of where we took things. So one of the main themes identified was a need to be less intimidating and more welcoming to new members, emerging artists in the community as a whole. So there's a strong desire to be the creative hub that fosters connections where artists meet, collaborate, and build community. And to do this, we need to continually reach out, engage with people who have often never heard of us before. So this renewal allows us to support the next generation of artists and move into the future. So it was an exciting process of engaging our community and then doing a lot of internal, ongoing dialogue, reflection, and creative exploration as a board, working through multiple rounds of names and identity proposals, But each stage, it really involved revisiting initial community feedback, testing ideas, and refining directions to ensure that the outcome would authentically reflect our values and our future. And that led us to where we are today. So by late fall, we had kind of decided on a direction and a name. And since then, we've just been working hard behind the scenes to carefully develop and finalize things ahead of the exciting launch on Friday.
Awesome. Thank you for that background. And I was wondering if you could walk us through the meaning behind the name Cultivate Art Commons and how that kind of reflects the feedback you guys got and those discussions that you guys were having.
Absolutely. So the word cultivate, it reflects the care, time, and mentorship required to grow an artistic practice. And it really speaks to our commitment to nurturing artists and creative ideas and supporting work that contributes to the broader community. Commons, on the other hand, refers to a shared space belonging to everyone. So it signals that we are an open and accessible hub where artists and community members come together. And it also reflects the practical resources that we offer, like affordable workshops, shared tools, equipment rentals, and exhibition space. I guess I'd also just like to really reinforce that this change is not a departure from our past. It's more of a deepening of purpose and a clearer way of expressing what we've always done and who we've been to the community.
Awesome. Yeah. And what's going to stay the same for artists and audiences? And what do you think is going to kind of change as you move forward with this new identity?
Yeah, I think like at the core, we are the same organization. Like we are not erasing anything from our past. We are still hugely proud of who we are as an organization, especially going into next year, which marks our 50th anniversary. So it's really, like I said, about a deepening of purpose and allowing us to more clearly represent who we are to communities that we've not engaged with before. And it's really an opportunity to share our story more boldly and connect with new audiences, and then really just reaffirm our longstanding commitment to artists in this region. So I think like those are kind of the changes that people might see, and obviously some visual changes, but ultimately it's really a leaning into who we've always been and the work we do that is so important.
And you had your launch event on Friday. I was wondering if you could speak to some of the reactions you guys got when you revealed this new identity.
Absolutely. It was a warm, uplifting event. The room was filled with people who've been supporting us over the years and who've been so deeply engaged in our programming, coming to events, exhibiting with us, teaching with us even. So it was so wonderful to gather with these really important people for us in our community and celebrate with them and have them be the first to know. There was obvious surprise, but I think that everyone there was able to really recognize that like this is an important change or shift for us as an organization, and we're able to just kind of carry that excitement forward and know that this is something we're doing in the best interest of this organization that we all know and love and have known in the past as Modern Fuel, but will now be knowing as Cultivate Art Commons. And I think that, yeah, there's just, you could really feel the love for this organization in that room that night. And the commitment to wanting to ensure that it's around for the next 50 years. And this is part of that strategy. So yeah, it was just a really beautiful celebration.
Once again, that was Maddie Andrews, Executive Director of Cultivate Art Commons. As Andrews said, while the name is changing, the organization's core mission remains the same, supporting artists through exhibitions, mentorship, workshops, and access to creative resources. As Cultivate Art Commons approaches its 50th anniversary in 2027, this new identity aims to reflect both its history and vision for a more connected arts community in Kingston. Kingston Parks will soon offer free access to sports equipment, as Council has approved a new pilot program set to launch this spring. The motion authorizes city staff to enter into a one-year agreement with Equip Sport to bring self-serve sports equipment stations to neighborhood parks across Kingston. The program, funded through Canadian Tire Jumpstart Charities, will install at least 30 secure equipment lockers where residents can borrow recreational gear for free using a mobile app.
The goal, to remove barriers to participation by making sports equipment more accessible and encouraging spontaneous, unstructured play. The initiative comes at no cost to the city, with all equipment, installation, maintenance, and insurance covered by the sponsorship. When it came time for council discussion, the only concern raised was around hours of use.
The one thing I did notice within the report mentioned basically these would be available 24/7. I have concerns about the hours of operation and how it may affect neighboring residents to the parks and having people playing different sports during, we'll say, non-operational hours.
I think it's really valid. I mean, who wants to hear basketball at 1 a.m? You know, this could cause more problems than we unintended consequences.
City staff quickly clarified that appropriate use hours can and will be put in place as part of the program rollout.
So the system does allow for 24/7 monitoring, but the system can be set for times that are appropriate for the neighborhood. We will implement that, and the hours that we will implement are 7 a.m. to 9 p.m., and this aligns with common use hours, but also public works staffing.
With that, council voted unanimously to approve the pilot.
I think this is a great movement, especially since we're just talking about accessibility, of allowing more people accessible access and to equipment for using our parks and recreation.
The program will launch this spring, with staff set to report back to council in the fourth quarter of 2026 with data on usage, accessibility outcomes, and recommendations on whether to renew or expand the initiative. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, March 26th, daytime high of 7, but with the rain in the forecast, it's going to feel closer to 2 degrees. Friday, March 27th, we have got a cold, sunny day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of -3, overnight low of -11, but in the sun, it'll feel closer to -1. Saturday, March 28th, daytime high of -2 with periods of sleet and freezing rain in the forecast. Sunday, March 29th, back above 0 for the first time in a few days. Daytime high of 3 degrees, periods of sun and cloud mixed throughout the day. And then starting off next week, more cold weather in the winter that never ends. Daytime high of -2. It will be sunny, so we could feel temperatures nip above 0, closer to 4 degrees in the sunshine. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. As a reminder, overnight street parking restrictions have been eased as of March 1st. You can park overnight on marked areas unless the weather conditions require it, i.e. think the heavy accumulation of snow or icy rain. All overnight street parking restrictions will be lifted as of April 1st. In terms of road closures, Berry Street to Queen is still closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Aberdeen from Johnson to William is currently closed to accommodate construction activity and staging in the area. And lastly, you can expect delays on Front Road to Sand Bay Lane for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Please be aware of lane shifts, traffic speed limits, and share the lane signage.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. From a request for up to $350,000 just weeks ago, city staff returned to council Tuesday night with a very different plan for marking the 10-year anniversary of the Tragically Hip's final concert, one that requires no new funding from the city's reserve. Back in February, council deferred a decision on allocating up to $350,000 from the city's working fund reserve, following major concerns from both councillors and the community. City staff were asked to revisit the proposal. Now, a revised report brings forward a scaled plan, focused on already planned free accessible programming, funded through existing budgets, sponsorships, and external sources. With additional work over the past month, staff say all city-led programming can now be delivered without withdrawing on reserve funds. Support includes up to $100,000 from Tourism Kingston's Municipal Accommodation Tax Development Fund, along with $23,500 already secured through sponsorship, with more funding opportunities still being explored. anniversary programming is now focused on expanding on initiatives already in place. When asked by council, city staff outlined how some of these events will take shape.
So the programming that the city is leading, outlined in the report, is twofold. So the first is a free music exhibition delivered through the Heritage Services Department. This is a broad music exhibition that has always been in the work plans, and that will be delivered throughout 2026 and 2027. Within that, there was an opportunity to align with the Tragically Hip anniversary, and so there is a section dedicated within that. So it's a broad music exhibition that is aligning where appropriate. The second is the free City of Kingston Rock in the Square concert that we deliver every single year in Springer Market Square. Given the celebrations and what we anticipate to be community interest, we are yet to announce the artist, but we will have some connection to the celebrations through this annual concert.
Additional programming that has been shared at this time also includes a downtown event later that weekend, new public art and murals, and a three-week run at the Kingston Grand Theatre of a new Canadian musical built around the band's catalog. Councillor Tozzo extended thanks to staff for revising the plan in response to feedback.
I just want to thank staff for listening to both council and the community, because I think that this sparked a little bit of concern about the appropriate use of funds. I'm very happy that the ask was reduced, that some of our partner groups and sponsorships are standing up. And I just want to reiterate, I love the Tragically Hip. I'm looking forward to celebrating this in a very financially responsible way. Thank you. Courage, it couldn't come at the worst time.
Council ultimately approved the updated approach, with Councillor Jeff McLaren casting the sole opposing vote. Staff will return to Council on June 16th with another update on programming as Kingston prepares to mark a decade since the Tragically Hip's final concert. After a decision at Council last night, the city will be looking into more eco-friendly alternatives to salt for de-icing roads. Councillor Ryan Bohm brought forward another winter road maintenance-related motion at last night's Council meeting, following a motion tackling plowing practices earlier this month. The motion asks that city staff prepare an information report that provides an assessment of alternative de-icing products, including operational performance, infrastructure requirements, cost implications, and environmental considerations. While sprinkling salt makes conditions safer for drivers and pedestrians, when all the chloride from that salt runs off into local waterways, it can be toxic for plants and wildlife, a concern that councillors have heard from constituents. The motion specifically mentions that councillors have received many inquiries regarding the potential use of beet-based organic additives, the alternative used in cities like Toronto, Kitchener, Waterloo, Cambridge, and Niagara.
Technologies change. Sometimes there's things that are more environmentally friendly. Sometimes they cost a lot more. So I've got multiple community inquiries about beet juice in particular. And so this is something where when I went to staff, essentially we don't have a lot of information on it. So the whole goal of this motion is to kind of go gather that information, see what other alternatives out there might be feasible, recognizing there may be cost constraints because the equipment might not be able to handle it. So, I mean, nothing beats having more information on things. So I hope this can be supported.
Council unanimously backed the motion after getting a few puns out of their system.
Well, it may look like I just fell off the turnip truck. I have heard from several constituents that the use of salt for ice management has them seeing red. And so I would really like to move forward with this.
I just don't think this motion can be beat.
Does anybody else have any jokes to make about resolution number one?
Council will receive an information report by Q4 2026 with options to move forward. City Council has formally declared student debt a municipal economic concern, recognizing that provincial student loan policy has direct consequences for the city's workforce, housing market, and long-term fiscal health. The motion comes in response to recent provincial changes to the Ontario Student Assistance Program. In February, the province restructured OSAP, shifting funding from 75% grants to 75% loans, ending the tuition freeze and introducing a 2% annual increase. The shift is expected to increase the average four-year undergraduate's debt by more than $7,000. Councillor Connie Glenn, whose district includes Queen's University, brought the motion forward.
So 3 years ago, I sat down with the students when we were forming the post-secondary working group. And the big question that I asked them was what their big concerns were and what they needed help with. And their answer was simple, food and housing. And I had the same conversations again recently. And now it's food, housing, and how am I going to pay off those loans when I graduate, let alone afford a house and a family? And the shift in 3 years tells us everything we need to know about where we're headed. Students and families who cannot afford to pay for school out of pocket now have to take out loans, loans that are going to have interest on them. And they're being asked to bet their future on debt before they even get started. Kingston is a post-secondary city. Queen's University and St. Lawrence College aren't just institutions. They're economic engines here in Kingston. They're community anchors. And what's happening to the students impacts all of us.
The motion points to growing local pressures, noting that rising student debt is pushing graduates away from smaller cities like Kingston toward higher-paying urban centers. At the same time, Kingston's senior population is growing at more than twice the provincial average, while working-age population has declined, creating an urgent need to retain young workers.
Our numbers are already telling a story we need to take seriously, and that was illustrated in the motion. We've got a senior population that's growing at twice the provincial average, our working-age population shrinking. The federal government workforce in Kingston area is projected to fall by 35% by 2031. Half the jobs in the city are education and healthcare sectors, and they're facing 18% near-term retirement rates, and we've been struggling to keep doctors and get doctors. So we're staring down a workforce crisis. And at the same time, we're making it harder and more expensive for people to train for the jobs that we need filled. So our community pays when a student in debt leaves because they can't afford to stay. We don't just lose a resident. We lose a doctor, a teacher, and yes, a taxpayer. And that loss is very real to us. It shows up in our housing market, our healthcare wait lists, our labor shortages. It shows up every day here.
The motion also directs city staff to bring forward a bylaw to add a post-secondary student representative to the city's Housing and Homelessness Advisory Committee. The motion will be shared with provincial leaders, local MPPs, student organizations, and municipal partners as part of broader advocacy efforts.
So the motion asks for three things that I think are very clear and reasonable. A return to a stronger grant-based model because grants open doors and loans close them. Interest-free provincial student loans following the federal government's lead. Recognition from this council that post-secondary education is a public good and not a private burden. Municipalities may not control LOSAP, but we live with the outcomes in our housing demand, our transit, social service, our economy. Affordability is not just a federal or provincial issue, as we all well know. It lands here first. We're the first to see it. And it lands the hardest here. So this is about fairness. It's about making sure that talents, not income, determines who gets to succeed, who gets to move forward with having that house and that family. Because when students start behind, our entire community is going to end up there.
When it came time to vote, council approved the motion unanimously. After a decision from council at Tuesday night's meeting, the city will begin exploring options to establish a formal process for handling unsolicited partnership proposals. While the city regularly receives partnership proposals from not-for-profit and private organizations related to various city services and programs, there is currently no standardized process to evaluate them. In the absence of clear guidelines, staff bring proposals to council for consideration and final approval. The motion notes that while this flexible approach has enabled creative and well-received partnerships, such as the Inclusive Playground, it has also led to confusion and assumptions from proponents and the public about how decisions are made. A key example came last year with a proposed soccer stadium at the Memorial Center, an idea that quickly escalated into widespread community concern and several tense council meetings and engagement sessions before ultimately being withdrawn. Councillor Vincent Shinani, whose district includes the Memorial Center, brought the motion forward.
So we all know where this comes from a soccer stadium proposal and at the Memorial Center, if you haven't heard about it. So I've had conversations with constituents for quite a while now, just a few of them, about there being a lack of policy or process for these kinds of proposals. And there was some inquiries about it, about the process and not having policy or process for unsolicited proposals. So it's been on my mind for quite a while, but then it's had a lot of community people wanting to see something happen. So I've had some conversation with some staff, and we did not have a formal process to deal with these kinds of proposals. So this motion is really to fill that gap of us not having such process.
Councillors voiced broad support, emphasizing the need for fairness and transparency in how proposals are handled.
Having a formal process actually makes this more fair for people in the community who have a proposal. It provides a guideline and a path of how to actually get this process moving. And what it prevents is sort of the accusations or perception of maybe unfairness, or, you know, they got theirs forward and they didn't, and I had a very similar proposal. So this kind of formalization of this policy is kind of what's been missing in the grand scheme of things. CAO Hurdle sort of mentioned the soccer one, which is near and dear to my heart. And I know that that's one where the city, we know, is without its own dome and something along those lines where we struggle sometimes with indoor soccer facilities. So in my mind, formalizing this actually provides an opportunity to be able to go to those private partnerships and say, look, here's our policy. You've had this interest. You want to support the city. Talk to the city. Go through this policy. Let's work together to try to fill some of the gaps in there. Public-private partnerships are going to be how we fill some of these funding gaps going forward. What I hope comes out of this is a framework that kind of knits public and private together so we can start to get some of these needed facilities in the city.
At the same time, several councillors cautioned against creating a process that is too rigid.
Thank you, Deputy Mayor Chnani, for this motion. I think we both experienced a tremendous amount of learning last year about this, and I will certainly never forget my email inbox filling up. I want to tell the other side of this, though, and that's my experience with the Inclusive Play Project, because that's a project that was embraced by the community, embraced by staff, embraced by council, and one that I think has had no real community blowback. And I see that we want to maintain flexibility. I have concerns. I agree. We need a formalized process. But I do have concerns we're going to become a city of no and not a city of yes. We want to be flexible. We want to be nimble. And we want to generate innovation as a city.
With unanimous support, the motion carried.
I know I focused on one thing, but it was kind of like the catalyst. So, but yeah, I really don't want this to be something that hinders, great ideas and great things that could be great for a community. I think it's just more about, you know, how is it? It could be consistent process that can get through. You know, that it doesn't have to be complicated. You know, it could just be okay. Is it financially viable? You know, like those kind. It could be like those kinds of questions and the same process for everyone. Where so like people can't look at this and say, oh, there was something happening behind the scenes, or, you know, that it's clear, that's, you know, a clear, nice process where, you know, we can just get things through and then weed out the ones that are, you know, really not kind of appropriate for certain sites and things like that.
City staff will now report back by the fourth quarter of 2026 with options for a formalized process to evaluate unsolicited partnership proposals from both nonprofit and private sector organizations. That's a wrap on all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information. Since its inception in 2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action. We'll be right back.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Plugged in My Ears podcast. We've got Adam, Kyle, and Sam here today. We're going to be talking NHL playoff race. We're going to take a look at some NHL awards. Big news in the world baseball environment, but we got to start with the Ottawa Senators' recent injury woes. The Sens right now are pushing for a playoff spot. They're 2 points out. Crucial game tonight on Tuesday against the Detroit Red Wings, who are currently 1 point ahead of the Senators. And they have two rookies making their debut on the blue line. So it's going to be interesting. Let's for some context, the defensemen that have gone down with injuries over the last little bit have been Jake Sanderson, Thomas Chabot, two of probably the Sens' best defensemen, and then Nick Jensen and Dennis Gilbert. Nick Jensen's kind of definitely their second pairing guy, and Dennis Gilbert they just traded for. So Carter Yakmachuk and Jorian Donovan are making their debuts tonight. Sam, Kyle, is this going to affect the Senators? I feel like that's kind of like an obvious question going in, because obviously rookies are going to affect the mojo of a team, but how big of a deal is this for the Senators regarding their playoff chances?
I think the biggest problem is that people always underestimate, like, Chabot used to get reamed on for years for hit, like, kind of like a Bouchard situation where, like, he had, like, bad defensive lapses. And, like, therefore, he was, like, a really bad player. But whenever he's not playing for the Sens, like, there's a noticeable impact. Like, his, especially 5-on-5, like, productivity 5-on-5 absolutely plummets when he's not playing. Mm. Like, it's actually brutal. Because the Senators do not have a lot of blue line passing strength other than Sanderson and Chabot. Yeah. But Chabot's main strength is actually 5-on-5 production, so... Yeah, like it's pretty brutal. Like it noticeable decrease in like chance for goals on 5-on-5, basically. Yeah. And then Sanderson, I mean, he's just all around good on everything: power play, defense, penalty kill. So yeah, that's pretty brutal. Like not too easy. I mean, especially given how tight standings are. Like, I mean, it's anybody's game at this point, really. Like, they could win 4 games in a row and stay in it, or they could lose 5 in a row and be completely sent home.
Yeah. Yeah. Sam, any thoughts on this?
Well, it's difficult to argue that the Sens aren't a little bit screwed, but I'll try and make the opposite argument simply for the benefit of people who want Ottawa not to lose. Sometimes having young guys is good. I think the best example is Larry Robinson. Larry Robinson was drafted in the second round to the Montreal Canadiens. He played on their farm team for a little bit, and then he got called up for a game to the NHL. And his dad called him and said, "You have one chance to stay in the NHL." And as we all know, in his first shift, he made one of the biggest hits in NHL history, absolutely smoked. I forget who it was. And lo and behold, he became one of the greatest defensemen Montreal's ever had. So that could be what comes out of tonight. Now, in all likelihood, that's not what's going to happen tonight, but it's still a possibility. And in fairness to the guys who did get called up, I mean, I know some of them a little bit. By some, I mean one. And so I'm happy to see Jorian Donovan get called up. He's an Ottawa kid, too. He's a huge Sens fan, so I think it's only fitting that he should play with the jersey that he knew growing up.
Nice, nice. So there's optimism in the air, then, is what I get from you, Sam. The playoffs right now are super tight. So right now, Ottawa's 2 points out, Detroit's a point out, and the Islanders and Bruins are separated by 1 point. And then behind the Senators, the Flyers are back by 3, the Capitals are back by 4, and then there's a bit of a drop-off to the Devils, Panthers, Leafs, and Rangers. But on the other side of things, the Habs are in third in the Atlantic, and they have the same amount of points as the Bruins. So it's like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then if you want to include Columbus and Pittsburgh, it's a 9-dog fight at this point for 4 spots. And like that's going to be like, I haven't seen a playoff race this tight in a long time. It almost feels unrealistic that all these teams in the East are as good as they are and are winning as often as they are. Every time I check the score the next day, it seems that every team that I needed to lose won, and that's been the kind of a recurring theme for the past 2 or 3 weeks. What team are you most surprised at right now? Because personally, I'm super surprised with Columbus. I did not see this run coming anywhere out of the Blue
really?
Jackets.
I mean, they got some great players. Merchenko, Werenski, mm-hmm. pretty underrated. Yeah. Buffalo, what are you talking about? Buffalo is crazy.
Buffalo's elite.
A wagon right
I'm not even counting Buffalo. I think that this team... They peaked really early, and of course this is the most surprising team, you know. But Buffalo is not even in the wild card scenario right now. Buffalo is insane. Like, I personally think they're going to lose first round, but they're insane.
No,
I think they're going to lose.
I think Buffalo's winning the cup.
I think they.
I like the goaltending though. I mean, their goaltending has turned out to be pretty solid.
Yeah,
that could help them win a first round game, but. I don't know. I'd be worried about their depth is decent, but I don't know.
Yeah, I honestly think this is a team that hasn't really made any big changes. It's just all of a sudden coming together. Like they just clicked now. Yeah. Sam, go ahead.
Maybe the coaching maybe was that bad. I guess. Like, geez.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the bigger issue is just that they're going to play a good team when they get to the first round. I mean, Kyle's right. It's not going to be easy. I still think Buffalo will win, but mm-hmm. does Buffalo really win 4 out of 7 times against Ottawa, Detroit, New York, or Boston? Or sorry, by New York, I don't mean the Rangers. I mean the Islanders, but mm-hmm. Probably not.
It'll be tough. It'll be a grind. There's no easy one
but
for them.
I think Tampa's a first-round knockout, too. That team has no business still being good at hockey. Their average age is retirement age.
Yeah, I wish
they
could
just
agree.
They have too many players that are just clicking. Like Darren Radish. Guys Darren just going nuclear.
Kucherov, I mean, criminally underrated.
It's actually ridiculous. Kucherov had 13 points in the last 4 games. 13 and 4.
That is insane.
That doesn't even make sense, actually. But you know who's had a great... I forgot to talk about this on the Senators. Warren Fogle. I liked him on the Oilers. I don't know what kind of bad voodoo is going on in the locker room in L.A., but they got to change the water bottles or something. As soon as he comes to Ottawa, he got 5 of his 9 goals in
That's
the season
crazy.
Right away. I mean, he's a good player. I don't know what LA is doing. They got the worst coaching in the league.
Yeah,
not even close.
That reminds me of Phil Deneau when Montreal traded for him. He's come to Montreal and he's awesome again. Like, he had no goals
he's
in
a
LA
good
this
player.
Year.
Like,
yeah, yeah. No,
he's one of the best two-way defensemen in the league. He always has been. Now he's kind of old now, though. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, I don't know what LA is doing. But it's not good.
No, that is a team that I'm not concerned about. Honestly, if I'm being completely honest, we'll talk about the West quick because really there's not much going on out there. Colorado and Dallas have already clinched, just to point that out. They got 102 and 97 points. I personally think that's inflated. I think it's because they're playing all these crap teams. I actually don't think Colorado or Dallas are as good as their records show. I'm not saying that they're not bad teams or anything, but I don't think that they are as good as the points show. Minnesota's pretty close to clinching. They're at 92, but the Pacific is so dog water. Like, Anaheim, 82 points, is leading the division right now. They're on track to like get 95 points this year and be division winners. That'd be the worst division winner in like the last 25 years, like excluding lockout shortened or COVID shortened seasons. And then the Golden Knights are 78 points, second place in that division, and the Oilers have 77. The Toronto Maple Leafs are only 4 points out of a playoff spot in the West, which is kind of nuts because they are significantly out of it in the East. So Nashville's a team that's kind of started getting hot at the right time. They're in a playoff spot now. They've kind of kicked out LA, Seattle, and San Jose, and they're starting to kind of gap Seattle and San Jose a bit. How sustainable do you think that is? Because I feel like the last team that gets in the West is probably going to be a first-round exit. Like, let's be completely honest. They're going to have to play Colorado in the first round. So Utah, Nashville, L.A., who do you like out of those ones? I know we don't like L.A., but do you think Nashville's sustainable to be able to make the playoffs?
I think Utah is a sneaker pick there, or not even sneaker in my opinion. They got a solid roster. They had a bunch of kind of like unfortunate injuries that were lingering. Like Logan Cooley was out for a while. He's kind of just getting back into it right now.
Yeah.
I think they're a better team than Nashville. They're just a lot younger. So they don't really have that experience. I don't know. I mean, actually, I'll say something about Colorado first. Colorado, any team that does not have good special teams will get exposed in the playoffs. They have a terrible like power play. You won't win. No. You will not win with that. Like, you actually won't. So they're going to have real problems if they face anyone good.
Yeah, I
mainly
also
probably like Dallas or yeah.
Go ahead, Sam.
Well, I don't really disagree with anything that's been said, but I do think that Nashville would have the best chance, only because Stamkos is kind of picking it back up. And so, you know, I made the unk rule at the start of the year. I said that once you reach a certain age and you stop getting a certain amount of points and a certain amount of games, you should be defaulted and forced to leave the league. And I didn't give Stamkos enough unk respect there, and for that I apologize. But now that he's getting hot, I actually think Nashville can go far because he's gone far in the playoffs. And when you have an old guy who's hot and who knows where he's going, you can get a lot of stuff done. I think Utah's really good too, though. And I actually think that Utah, if they were to play Colorado, would bring it to seven. I think Nashville could beat Colorado. I know that's crazy to say, but I think they could. I don't think LA could do it, though. If LA came in that last wild card spot, I don't think they could do it. But regardless, I think both Utah and Nashville could beat Minnesota. In a hypothetical world where Minnesota gets up there.
I agree with both of you, but I think the strongest team out of these teams is still San Jose. I think that 70-point San Jose Sharks team, that record does not represent how good that team is. I saw them manhandle the Canadiens, and maybe the Canadiens just aren't that good, but they beat them twice in 2 weeks, and the games look very similar. And I think that San Jose could actually put up a fight against any of these teams, especially the teams in the Pacific. I wouldn't be surprised if they're able to go on a little bit of a run and sneak in, especially with the Oilers not having Leon Draisaitl. I would not be surprised if the Oilers miss the playoffs with this. I know, Sam, you and I talked about this last week a little bit about the chances of them making the playoffs. Kyle, Edmonton Oilers specialist over here, what do you think about the Draisaitl injury and how devastating that will be to the Oilers? So are we overreacting? Is Connor McDavid still going to carry the team to the promised land?
I think the problem, there's larger structural issues on the Oilers. I've been a nurse executionist from the start, but you know, this guy instead of learning, like, I think he hits his head in the locker room or something, man, because every game he learns less. He knows less than the game previous, and he makes more mistakes. Like, this guy's actually gotten worse over the season, like, substantially. He started the season okay.
Mm-hmm. I remember that, yeah.
He's been abysmal every single game. You look at the score sheet or the scorecard of, like, you know, play performance above or under expectations, bottom. He's bottom almost every time. Jake Walman's had some pretty brutal games too. I mean, Bouchard's been unreal.
Yeah.
Absolute machine out there. McDavid's been doing like whatever he can to like pull out something together. I think the Oilers are actually a very bad team that just happens to have a handful of really, really good players that carry it every single year. They had some depth in the previous years and they've seemed to have lost almost all their depth.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sweating. If I'm the Oilers manager right now, I'm sweating big time because McDavid is done. He's tired. I said that the not getting the gold medal in the Olympics was a big problem for the Oilers. I think it is. I think it's going to be a major problem because McDavid wants to win something.
Yeah.
I don't see how they can convince him to sign long term.
Absolutely.
When he
not.
Comes time to re-sign. He already did the kind of sweetheart deal and like look what they used that money for, right? Like they just blew it on like Tristan Jarry.
Yeah.
Like what?
Not who I'd be
like that was
money
what
on.
They expended the extra cash on. Like yeah. I don't understand these like lateral moves that just give you like a marginal like basically equivalent player for more money. But yeah, they got some huge issues. I don't understand the mentality of they should have sold the farm a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of just dragged things out because they were just too nervous to kind of go all in on a season.
Yeah.
And I think that they kind of missed the window a little bit there, burnt some of their assets and not looking so hot now. I think a lot of some of those contracts are going to age real poorly.
Yeah.
The Walman one's looking somewhat dicey. I mean, they signed a bunch of defensemen for just way too much money. Like, I don't really understand what the philosophy was there, but I think they're going to squeak into the playoffs, but they might have an unfortunate early exit.
Yeah, because they would end up having to play most likely. I still assume that they would probably either get top three in the Pacific, or they would end up. They're going to have to play a Pacific team no matter what, because I do think I don't think they'll be the last team in. I think that they'll end up either playing Vegas or Anaheim or
Yeah, Vegas or Anaheim essentially is essentially who their matchup's going to be against. And I think that that's a favorable matchup for them because I don't think Anaheim or Vegas are very good at all. So, like,
no.
I think their challenge is to get there. And if you get to the second round and Dreisaitl's back and healthy, I wouldn't be surprised if they go a little further. I they've done it before, you know? I feel like it's a weird year. It's a weird regular season right now. And I think that things could turn around come playoff time for them, but that is that's me being very optimistic. McDavid and Draisaitl are going to have to work it like they haven't worked it before in order to will this team to the final.
I think the other effect I've noticed, I mean, this doesn't apply to all players, but a lot of players that came back from the Olympics seemed a little tired. Like you can just see it in their production. Like, a lot of Olympic players kind of had slow starts when they came back. Hagel kind of started slow. Gensel a little bit. Matthews stone cold and went straight to the hospital box. A bunch of these guys. McDavid, not that slow, but like slow for him, I guess. He was a bit like clearly a little tired when he came back. So I think that had a bit that kind of played a weird impact, I feel like, on some of these teams.
Yeah. So the Athletic released their mid-season, but I guess with 10 games to go, rankings for each award. And there's some interesting names up there for the Hart. We'll talk about that one first, but the top three were pretty reasonable. Nathan MacKinnon, Nikita Kucherov, and Connor McDavid. I think that it's between MacKinnon and Kucherov, personally. I don't think McDavid can salvage this year, personally, especially if the Oilers finish with less than 95 points. I feel like that'd be tough to give the Hart to, especially with MacKinnon and Kucherov having insane seasons this year. I think Kucherov is definitely overlooked when it comes to this. I think, like I said before, MacKinnon is playing on a much better team with much better players, and Colorado's playing easier teams. So I think that Kucherov really is my pick to win the Hart, but what do you guys think? Are you team MacKinnon or team McDavid? Or, I mean, the fourth place guy they have on the list is Lane Hutson. So, I mean, are you a Lane Hutson guy? Because I guess it is the most valuable player to your team. So, I mean, I can see that.
I mean, to be honest, I think the Olympics plays a big factor in that, because you can say McDavid and MacKinnon, like, their production did slow after the Olympic break.
Yep.
Whereas Kucherov had like a nice two long weeks of rest, and he came back firing on all cylinders. Now, I mean, like, that's not really an excuse for like necessarily like all of the points or whatever, but
yeah,
I think it did play like a small factor in it. I think Kucherov's been insane. He's carried, like, the only reason why Tampa is anywhere it is right now is because of him. He turned Darren Radish into like a top defenseman somehow. The guy was like I don't know how much he gets paid right now. I think he gets paid like under $2 million a year. Like he was like a fourth liner. He's got one of the best like cost to point ratios in the league.
Yeah, they've got Radish in eighth for the Norris. That's pretty impressive.
Absurd. This guy's. I mean, great for the guy. Like he's gonna get that money now.
Yeah,
because he's a UFA, I think, in the summer.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I mean, Tampa has some seriously underrated players like on that whole roster. Like, Gensel would be like a star player alone on any team. He's one of the best players in the American like Olympic team.
Yeah.
And he's like still playing like second or third fiddle on that team. So, yeah. I mean, and same with Hagel. Like, Hagel's super underrated 5-on-5 player.
Yeah. No, like you said, though, slow coming back from the break. Sam, what's your take on the Hart this year? You think it's a MacKinnon McDavid race, or do you think Kucherov's got a real chance?
I don't know. It's difficult to say, but I think it's going to go to MacKinnon right now. Mm-hmm. Although it really should go to Cooch, I think, but I do think it's going to go to MacKinnon. It's just like, look, it is a pretty numerical thing, let's be real. I mean, as much as we can say, like, oh, you know, like, Cooch has more points, that's never really mattered. I mean, he's 5 goals behind MacKinnon. I don't think McKinnon's going to stop scoring much anytime soon. Kucherov might start scoring more, though, which is true. But that's what I see happening. Now, Cole Caulfield, though,
yeah,
could catch up. Is he not? He's not that far out. I mean, it's not unrealistic, is it?
For the heart, I don't think he's got enough assists for the heart. And I saw a video today that's saying Cole Caulfield's like the third most valuable player on the Habs. Like Lane Hutson and Nick Suzuki are still more valuable than Cole Caulfield, somehow, which is crazy. But I think it's just Caulfield's got a real shot at the Rocket. I think if he keeps scoring at the rate that he's scoring, like he's what, 2 goals back of McKinnon now?
Yeah.
I think he can take it. I think he can get 50. I mean, Sam, you were at the game. Like the crowd wants it. If he played every game for the rest of the year at the Bell Center, I think he'd have 60.
I mean, potentially. It's pretty impressive to watch him play. Though I got to say, he doesn't really do that much if he doesn't have the puck.
No.
But he is on a very good line, though, and he does finish well. But sorry, I was speaking about the Hart Trophy there. Mm-hmm. I guess what I said is kind of stupid, because if Kucherov has the most points, he'll get it. I guess my point is more just this. I think McKinnon will surpass him anyways.
Yeah. I don't know, though. I feel like you're right.
Have you given the Hart Trophy to anyone who didn't have the most points? Like, I'm just saying this based off the fact that McKinnon
Price
has 4 goals per point.
Carey Price won the Hart.
Really?
Yeah. They can go to a goalie. The only goalie they had on the list was Logan Thompson, and I'm like,
He's been pretty superb. I don't know.
He has been superb.
Underrated goalie.
Yeah. No, it's just like for a team that isn't making the playoffs, I thought that was surprising to see their goaltender on there. But yeah, no. I think that both players have a chance. I do think McDavid's fallen off, but like not significantly, but I do think when it comes to the MVP, I don't think that he's really had an MVP year just based off of his team's results. A name that wasn't up there, which I did think would be up there, is Macklin Celebrini, because he's having an insane year and very valuable to his team. But I guess the Sharks just aren't there yet for the Athletic.
I think if his team makes the playoffs, I think he might deserve it, to be honest.
Oh, I would put him up there 100%. I think he would deserve it if they make the playoffs.
I mean, he's single-handed. Like, it's not like you can like attribute it to like a couple players on that team. It's like no, like it's literally single-handedly him the reason why they're even close to a playoff spot right now.
It's phenomenal how well he's played. A few of the other names they have on the list here is Mo Sider from Detroit, Zach Werenski on the Blue Jackets, Jason Robertson on the Stars, Quinn Hughes on Minnesota, and Rasmus Dahlin from the Sabres. So I guess they're just like really looking at leadership guys on the teams that are in the playoffs, and I guess that's kind of what MVP is supposed to kind of represent. But I do think that it is really a three dog race when it comes to the Hart this year, just with how well McKinnon, Kucherov, and McDavid have played, and then some, as we said, Celebrini if the Sharks are able to squeak their way into the playoffs. Do you guys want to talk about the Norris a little bit? Norris, Vezina. What do we think?
Yeah, I think the Norris one's there's some interesting kind of. I mean, there's some underrated players. Quinn Hughes, like.
Yeah,
I feel like he's kind of been like overpumped this season. I'm not gonna lie.
I agree. They got Quinn Hughes at
number
7.
Bit of an underwhelming performance.
Yeah. I thought he was gonna be a lot better when he went to Minnesota. Like he's been very good. He's been like. It's hard to critique him.
It
feels different.
Bad team effect. It's like the same thing that happened with Erik Karlsson. Like, he was on the Sharks, and everyone was like, oh my God, like, this guy got 100 points on the Sharks. Like, what's going to happen when he goes to, like, a good team? Like, you know, but it's not really necessarily doesn't work like that way, because when you're on a really bad team, like, everything runs through you.
Yeah.
So every single play was running through Karlsson, so that's why he had, like, that many assists. I think it's kind of the same deal with Quinn Hughes on the Canucks a little bit. Like, he was just running their program. Like, there was just everything was going through him.
Yeah.
Whereas Minnesota's got way more options.
Yeah, no, that is true. I do think that looking at the top few players that they have for the Norris, it's a healthy mix of defensemen that are just seem to be offensive defensemen and defensemen that are kind of more well-rounded. So they've got Cale Makar at number 1 and then Lane Hutson at number 2. And I think both of those are very offensive defensemen, but Makar definitely has the edge on defense. And then on the third place spot is Mo Sider, who is a very defensive defenseman, does the job well. If the trophy was for defensive defensemen, I feel like Mo Sider would be winning this trophy. And then behind him, they've got Zach Werenski and Evan Bouchard. Two guys that are having crazy offensive seasons this year. Like those four with Hudson and Makar being more defensive than Makar being more defensive than Bouchard and Werenski. It's just interesting to see how the defenseman has changed throughout the years. And I guess I always thought that Erik Karlsson and PK Subban winning the Norris way back in the day was like impressive because they were like the only offensive defenseman like kind of in the NHL. Like it would usually go to a defensive defenseman if it wasn't going to one of those two. And now I just feel like it's overpowering, overwhelming with the amount of offensive defensemen in the Norris. Sam, what are your thoughts on the Norris? Who do you think's got it this year?
I think it's going to go to Makar.
Yeah.
Because only because of what you just said. But I would put it this way, though. Like what Karlsson and Subban brought to the NHL, I think that Makar amplified to a degree which is hitherto unknown by the league. He's insane defensively and offensively. Like, I don't know. It's basically just having a Connor McDavid on defense.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only difference is there's no Cale Makar on offense. That's how good Cale Makar is right now.
Yeah. No, he is insane. Definitely one of the best players in the NHL. I thought he would be up there for the Norris, too, but I guess when you have so many players that are good on Colorado, it's kind of hard to choose one for who would be the most. It's hard to determine who's the most valuable player on that team, but I think MacKinnon is kind of clear, far and away the favorite. Sam or Kyle, are you also with Sam on this? You think it's going to be Cale Makar, or you think one of those other four got a chance?
I mean, Lane Hudson, I kind of like him. I think Bouchard is way underrated on that list. Because not because of just his number, like offensive numbers, his defensive numbers have not been bad. They're actually quite good. I don't know why they're so overlooked, but I don't know. Yeah. I mean, he doesn't make like crazy fancy defensive plays, but his defensive numbers are pretty good.
So I guess the way they scored this was they assigned like a 1 to 15 for offense and then a 1 to 15 for defense. And then like whoever got the highest rating overall, I guess
but
that's
it's,
how they
it's
did
assi- it. But the defensive score is assigned. I think it's an objective thing. No, yeah. It's not based on.
It's objective.
Interesting.
Yeah, but Bouchard.
Because I feel like you can calculate, like, there's a lot of defensive metrics you can calculate. Like,
oh, yeah.
They're very easily, you know, viewable.
Yeah. But the fact
feel like it's kind of like, you know, baseball almost, like, where, like, there's some things you just can't see. Like, you're just like, oh, that guy looks great.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he does look great at defense, but then you look at the numbers and it's like, oh, like this guy that like kind of looks like a goof on the ice, like actually somehow stops more pucks. I don't know how, but he does.
Yeah. The Darnell
like
Nurse
it's
effect.
It's more of a, I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens with Quinn and Makar. Like they're just fantastic skaters.
Yeah.
They're such good skaters and they look so clean on the ice. Whereas Bouchard is clunky skater. He's got lead boots. Like he's not a pretty skater.
Yeah.
So all of his defensive plays just look super choppy because he's kind of like tripping around.
Yeah.
But I guess it works.
No, it'll be really interesting to see who comes away with it. I feel like it's a tight playoff race. It's a tight awards race. And I think that just makes the league more exciting. So I'm kind of happy to see there's not really one team running away with it this year, and there's not really one player running away with it this year. I feel like it's really going to come down to these last few games. And hey, we're 10, 11 games away from the playoffs. I'm really excited. I feel like everyone here is really excited. We'll only be able to cover a little bit in as the school year comes to a conclusion. But we want to say thank you for joining us tonight, and we'll see you next week.
Spring is in the air, which means it's time once again for the Banre Foundation's annual spring celebration. Join us as we recognize the incredible achievements of mature women students at Queen's University. The festivities will take place at Grant Hall on May 2nd at 2 p.m. This is a free event and everyone is welcome to attend. Find event details by visiting the Banre Center website, following us on Instagram or Facebook, or emailing brc@queensu.ca. Come celebrate exceptional women with us. See you there!
We'll start with some general ways to turn ugly duckling emotions into swans. First.
Rock. Rock, rock, rocket.
Second.
Rock. Rock, rock, rocket.
Third. This is what one doctor suggests.
Yeah, yeah.